Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA here in Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Trevor Storrs. He's executive director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, and Terry Brammel. Terry is a physician's assistant, and she works as an HIV clinical specialist with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Today, we're going to be looking at what's new about HIV and AIDS, particularly in Alaska. We'll talk about new recommendations for testing for HIV and for AIDS, anything we need to talk about treatment, and perhaps some little bit new information about the origin of the human immunodeficiency virus, the HIV virus. You can reach us with your questions and comments during today's program over the next hour. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Terry, welcome to Line One. I think this is your first time to visit with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you join us. And Trevor, nice to have you back.
Always a pleasure.
What got us here today, besides just a general need to review AIDS, is that December 1st is World AIDS Day. You want to tell us a little bit about the purpose of that?
World AIDS Day has many folds to it, but the most important piece of World AIDS Day is to remember those that we have lost to the disease. We do a candlelight vigil with that every year, and we do what's called the calling of names. For anybody that we're able to, we will call out their name at the vigil and remember them, and remember the fight that they lost, but also the support they have given when they were with us. It is also to bring awareness to the community. So many people, especially here in Alaska, when I travel and I tell them what I do, they go, AIDS is in Alaska. It's really important to let people know it is here. It's not a high incidence state. However, it's still very important to remember that it is here, and we need to be aware of it. And finally, through awareness, it's also to encourage people to know their own HIV status, if they are positive, to access services, things of that nature.
It's going to be important for listeners to understand the need for being aware of your status as we begin to talk about this problem a little later, and how we are beginning to get a little bit of a better handle on it, and the efforts are trying to be made to decrease new cases, and that gets to some testing questions. But before we get to that, I'd like to mention that it also seems to me, and I'm somewhat in the media, that we don't hear as much about HIV and AIDS as we maybe did 10 years ago. The focus seems to have gone to the chronic diseases, obesity, and diabetes and those kinds of issues. It's still around. We've made some headway, but we need to still be aware of this problem.
Absolutely. Well, we all know media, and the way they work is they take the hottest topic and they run with it, and when the new topic comes along. In HIV, we unfortunately just celebrated its 30th anniversary from when it was first identified back in 1981 in June. In 30 years, it's no longer the new topic. And actually, HIV gets good attention when we do make great strides or new information is put out there. So I recognize that the media does give attention when required, but we are reaching that kind of plateau at times of those new advances, or the new advances are not as quick as when it was first disease. But also the great exciting, you talked about the chronic piece of it. HIV back in the 80s, it was definitely, when you got an AIDS diagnosis, it was pretty well a death sentence. People had an average of 16 to 18 months to live. Now HIV is truly a chronic disease. And the exciting part currently is we have probably, with the advances of medicine and so forth, they have said that we have now just surpassed that. HIV has been more a chronic and treatable disease than it has been in the sense of untreatable. So we are making some great advances.
And you have to be diagnosed before you can begin to treat that. And we're going to talk about some of the problems with getting that diagnosis. Before we go there, and again, this is my own editorial preferences, I'm very interested in how these new diseases came about. We used to think that this suddenly just appeared. Now there's been a lot of good science and epidemiology suggesting that this problem probably occurred or began, I think, as I recall, in some of the information I'm reading, about the 1920s. We talked about this a little bit, Terry, before we came on there. What's your understanding of what we know about the origins?
Well, now? I was actually listening to a podcast last night that mentioned that it had been identified in tissue as early as 1908, tissue that had been preserved for that long. So it's been around a lot longer than we have been aware of it.
Yeah. My understanding is that it certainly did appear, the earliest we can find is some evidence in Africa, Central Africa, and that the evidence of similar kinds of viruses in monkeys, particularly I think chimpanzees, that were slaughtered by natives. They may have gotten the blood. They got the virus somehow. Then it was able to adapt. And then very, very, very slowly, person-to-person transmission got started. And it took a long time for us to be aware of it. Is that kind of what people are understanding now?
Absolutely. I always talk about there used to be an old myth that way HIV came over here to the U.S. was there was a flight attendant who actually went over to Africa, had inappropriate sex. It was described to me differently, came over, and then it spread. Mm-hmm. And the only part that—and actually, the inappropriate sex was with monkeys, and that's not the case. Right. It's definitely linked to the chimpanzees as well, as it's very similar to the concept of the bird flu. It takes time, and it has that it basically mutates and then can live within the humans and become the HIV virus.
The— you know, viruses are known to jump species. Certainly HIV is one now, we know. The swine flu, influenza viruses, we know. What really causes a problem is it's got to be able to jump from species to species, and it's got to be spread person to person. Those are important criteria. Really bad things happen when that virus causes deadly diseases, and HIV is that one particular one that is very dangerous because humans don't have any natural, or very few of us have any natural immunity. There seem to be some that may have some very, very rare immune situations. I think where the virus just can't even bond to the cells to get in the lymphocytes. But that's a rare problem. So this is not an unusual situation. It just takes a bad combination of events for things like this to happen. Before we talk about the AIDS Assistance Association, let's talk some more then about HIV. How does that cause illness? What do we mean by AIDS as a consequence of that as well?
Well, HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus, and that's what is transmitted from person to person. And AIDS is the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and we diagnose somebody with that if either their CD4 count, which is the white, it's one of the helper cells that the HIV attacks and depletes, when that drops below 200, or they have one of a list of about 29 opportunistic infections, then they get a diagnosis of AIDS.
So this virus, the HIV virus, preferentially kind of attacks some of the lymphocytes, in the, particularly the what are called CD4, and destroys those.
Yeah, and they're kind of the conductors of the symphony of the immune system, or the white blood cells, and so they kind of wipe out the top, and the immune system still functions, but there's immune dysfunction.
And normally, we're all exposed to some of these very unusual infections all the time, and our immune system handles them. But once you get this infection with HIV, then we start having trouble, and that's a signal that our immune system is something's amiss. And not always, but it can be HIV infection that's done that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Transmission. How do people get HIV infections?
Well, they get it. A lot of people focus on the behaviors, and it's not about a certain behavior gives you HIV. It's coming in intimate contact with potentially four fluids that carry it, and if a person's infected. So we're talking blood, semen, vaginal fluid, or breast milk. But it's more than just coming in contact. We have a natural barrier to basically allowing things to enter our body, and it's called our skin. We have the outer skin, which everybody has, like on the back of your hand, all throughout your body, and then there's kind of that inner skin that's inside, like your mouth, inside the anus, the vagina, so forth. And that's a natural barrier. But when there's a break in those barriers, so i.e. the skin is broken open, there's a tear, that's when our white blood cells are then exposed, our T cells. And if the infected liquid comes in contact with the T cell, that's when the HIV can then basically clamp onto that T cell and then enter our system.
So sexually transmitted, needle sticks, you've mentioned breast milk. Also, there's the vertical transmission from a mother who's infected. We didn't really maybe clarify that that would be a bloodborne way of thinking about it, but that actually happens. How about the breastfeeding question? I did not look that up beforehand. Is that a common mechanism or a not-so-common mechanism?
Not here, but over in Africa, absolutely. Mm. That's their primary way of feeding, or in other third-world countries. Here in the U.S., we have done a very good job. In most developed countries, I hate using that word, developed, but the Western culture and so forth, we have been able to take the necessary strides in really minimizing the number of mothers that give birth to basically babies that are positive. And we're able to do that by one quick screening. It's very common and it's very much encouraged. And most practices in states actually require that a mother is given an HIV test. If she hasn't, even before she's given birth, with a new rapid test, they can get results in 20 minutes. So they can take the necessary precautions before birth to really minimize the chance of it being transmitted to the infant, as well as if the infant is born, they're able to provide specific medications to greatly reduce again. And the way to keep the baby from being positive afterwards, if coming out that way, is not to breastfeed, and there's other ways of feeding the child. In your less developed countries, third world, that's much more difficult, and mothers will depend on it, and it's a very high transmission rate.
It's about a 12% transmission rate.
From a mother
is breastfeeding
infected.
to a baby, and that's a big problem in Africa because they don't have water and formula to have a good alternative to breastfeeding.
So a mother who may be infected and knows she's infected has very little option sometimes.
Yeah, unless if she's on medications, that's going to decrease
the load, the likelihood. Okay. All right. Let me remind our listeners again, we're talking about HIV and AIDS with Trevor Storrs, Executive Director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistant Association, and Terry Bramall, a HIV clinical specialist at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. If you've got questions or comments, our local number today is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Let's stay with these transmission things because I think there's some myths and misconceptions as well. One that may not be a misconception, except maybe it's on my part, is I know Native Americans, I believe it's true that Native Americans at times may chew up food and then give it to younger children so they kind of pre-masticate the food. Is that a common way of handling food for young infants in Native Alaskans, and is that a potential way to transmit HIV infection?
It definitely is something that's done in both the Alaska Native culture and the lower 48 Native culture, and there have been documented cases of transmission in the lower 48, not in Alaska, that we're aware of, but it's something that we've only been aware of the last few years, so it's become new to our radar to talk to people about that.
Again, the issue would be a secretion of some human fluid that has to get through the blood to the blood barrier, preferably if there was a lesion in the mouth in particular, maybe during dental work, those kinds of things is when this stuff happens. How about transfusions? What do we need to say about the risk of HIV through transfusions today?
There's zero. There has been no record since the 80s when they were able to identify and test the blood. There's outstanding precautions in places like the U.S. and your other developed countries that are in place to make sure that does not happen. But again, if you're looking at places like Africa, places that do not have those types of either procedures, process, equipment, or the ability to be able to do that, that's another story. But here in the U.S., it's been since the mid-80s since anybody has received HIV through a transfusion.
Okay. tattooing took a hit initially with HIV and some hepatitis C transmission. How much of a risk is that today? We certainly cannot fail to see that there are a lot of tattooing going on.
Well, if tattooing is done by a licensed tattoo parlor that uses clean equipment, then it's not really a risk. But if it's not a licensed, you know, if it's sort of a fly-by-night that may be reusing needles and not sterilizing properly, including the ink, or in some of the native cultures and other cultures, prison culture, tattooing is done. And of course, in prison, they aren't supposed to have needles, so they do get reused, and that is a concern.
So the way that would happen, again, is a person who is infected contaminates a needle. Then is used again without being cleaned.
Correct. Or in the ink is what I've heard.
Or in the ink as well. Mm-hmm. And the next person may get that issue. How about insects and mosquitoes? Those are cause bleeding, and we know any way to think about, is that a risk factor for HIV?
No.
If it was, we'd be in big trouble up here
in Alaska.
So there are illnesses that are spread. The problem here is that I guess mosquitoes aren't infected, so they can't transmit this.
No, and they actually have an enzyme in their proboscis that kills the virus, and they don't inject blood in.
Another question, sometimes related maybe to daycare, is human bites as a possible transmission factor.
Now, HIV is not carried in saliva. Again, what you have to do is have the presence of one of the four fluids. So if there's no blood, no semen, vaginal or breast milk present, then no. So just because somebody bites. Now, if you bite somebody who's HIV positive, you break the skin, you get exposed to their blood, there's now a risk. But if you have good oral health, there's no break in your skin, you've cleansed out your mouth, things of that nature, the risk is low. So biting, spitting, extremely low risk. And if you're positive and you're doing the biting, unless you've got some blood in your mouth and you're putting it onto that individual, again, there's little to no risk.
How about the efforts to help prevent transmission and acquisition of HIV and maybe hepatitis C as well with IV drug users? There's programs that are designed to provide safe needles. Those get different kinds of thought processes involved. Does this work? What's the national evidence or the international evidence on the success and reasons for this kind of preventative efforts?
Syringe exchange has been around since the 70s, actually before HIV, and specifically to address hepatitis. And they got even more attention when they could address HIV. They are the number one intervention that can be utilized for the IDU community, intravenous drug users. And the reason for that is basically a lot of people, or the controversy is, it's the concept that if you give a needle to somebody, you're encouraging drug use. And as an organization that provides syringe exchange program, we've been doing it since 07, I've had nobody come into our agency and go, thank you for giving away needles, now I can start using drugs. Everybody who comes in has already been a user and actually been using for some time. What they're thankful is there is a source to them that ensures that they can stay healthy or healthier with their current choices. The needle does not promote it. What evidence does show, and there's been case after case, is one, that it actually encourages people to access treatment. A lot of people turn to drugs for self-medication. There's other things going on, the drug use, whether it be through injection drugs and or at times alcohol, is actually a symptom of other issues. So people do that self-medicating. They don't have a sense of self-worth. Then you add the stigma of being an IDU user. Basically, even scum is better than you. So these folks, when they come in, they don't feel anything. And I don't mean because of the drug, but because of our society. Well, they have an organization that, one, doesn't hide them. They're welcome. They're given the same treatment as anybody else. It's a nice place. The syringe exchange is an appropriate professional place. We talk to them. We find out what's going on. We start showing them that we care because they have actually some value as a person. They start internalizing that. They start reducing their use, and they start also looking at treatment. We've actually, I personally have had at least three or four people come up to me out in public. I don't recognize them. And they go, "You work for that syringe place, don't you?" And I go, "Yes." And they go, "Why don't you know I used to be there, and you guys really saved my life." Mm-hmm. They're now clean. They went through treatment and so forth. It makes a huge difference. It also lessens down the crime because people are using less. They're looking at treatment. They're not participating in crime. It also keeps the community safe. They return the needles, whether they get them from us or from others. They have more inclination of sharing it with law enforcement before they get frisked, things of that nature. So overall, it has been seen and evidence has shown that actually syringe exchange programs are a positive addition to any community.
Is there still a lot of resistance despite that evidence, or is...
Of course. Of course. Sorry, I'm not even going to let you finish. Of course there is. It's really hard to get beyond that by giving out these supplies that it's going to encourage. They're going to use more.
Yeah.
And every time we've talked to these individuals and said, you know, what happens if we have less? We can't give you needles. Well, we'll just reuse the ones we have.
Right.
We'll just share. They will. The power of the withdrawal and the pain that is created is much greater than the concern that, yeah, I might get infected with something. That's least on the radar. So what we do is we provide that, and it really starts opening up again that door for conversation. If we don't open up that door, show a level of respect and understanding, these people will be completely lost, and all people have a value. And unless we start showing it and showing them, we're going to lose them, and the problem is just going to get bigger. We, in our opinion, have seen the issue decrease.
And the reason for providing the needles, other than just being a humanitarian and respecting the worth of an individual, and that any of us perhaps could be in that situation and recognizing that, is that we need to do that to help prevent new acquisition of disease and transmission, it would seem to me.
Well, there's always the human side of it. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody gets that. I just talked about it. Let's talk about the economic side of things. Most of these individuals would end up on the welfare system. They would access the safety net like ourselves. They would access all the programs that are supported on the federal level. So if we get a bunch of new cases and they keep growing, we don't provide this, we're almost at the point of basically running out of funds. So you're going to have a greater need and greater strain placed on the community, as well as if people are reusing the same syringes, whether they get the disease or not, they're going to have abscesses, they're going to have issues, they're going to be accessing your ER system, they're going to be greater dependent on the emergency service system, all of that. Economically, it's going to be a huge expense. And then all these people are going to find themselves in jail versus working towards treatment. No, those four people stopped going through the revolving door. All of them went through jail at least once. All of them didn't go back. So we saved us hundreds of thousands of dollars just there with those four people. Now we have the disease. We're talking millions of dollars. And that's just here in Alaska. Take that nationally. So economically, it's an appropriate investment. Do I wish we did not have to do this because there was not an issue? Absolutely. But until we as a society address some of the other issues that are causing the issue for these people to self-medicate, we're always going to have it. And until we can do that, we're going to continue providing this and be a service to our community.
You mentioned that there's a stigma associated with a drug use, which is I don't know how it ranks compared to sexually transmitted amounts of HIV, but certainly I would think drug abuse and IV drug use and sex are the two big reasons. So there are some stigma associated with sexual practices, which also prevent people from getting care.
Oh, absolutely. Probably the number one issue that we're addressing here, not just in Alaska, but nationally and internationally, is HIV stigma. it's my personal opinion that stigma is actually probably the number one cause for transmission. And what I mean by that is stigma prevents people from addressing their issues and what they're internally struggling with, whether it be on the drug use and what's causing that drug use, or even on a sexual level. Here in the U.S., a lot of people, and the myth was back in the 80s, if you remember in 81 when it was first identified, it was known as GRID, gay-related immune deficiency syndrome. It was plastered, it was a gay issue. And for 30 years, even though that belief has decreased, it's still out there. People still think it's a gay disease. Granted, men who have sex with men, now that's not gay, that's men who have sex with men, and we'll get into that in a second, are still our highest number here in the U.S. In Africa, it's heterosexual. In Eastern Europe, where it's growing very fast, is through IUD use as their number one transmission. Here in the U.S., it's men who have sex with men. Because of the stigma that is related to men having sex with each other and so forth, that really causes people to go underground, which causes them to hide it, not take the precautions to protect themselves. Because if they did, and those precautions, i.e. condoms, lube, were ever discovered and questioned, they're really concerned that their identity would be known, and then they would have to now face that stigma. And that stigma has caused people to lose their families, their friends, their jobs, their natural supports, everything that they are accustomed to, as well as it's a huge internal struggle for many people. It's not an easy thing just to go, I'm this, especially when it's not accepted by the people that you know or your own values that you've been brought up with, right or wrong. So it's huge. And then because two men have sex with men, that's automatically labeled as gay. And there's controversy out there. Yes, if you look at the definition, heterosexual is when a man has sex with a woman. Homosexual is when have sexual relations. Well, as a gay man, there's a lot more to me than who I have sex with. And my relationship with my partner is much greater than that as well. Many people do not identify themselves as gay. No different. When I eat Italian food, I don't consider myself Italian. Right. Just because you have sex with another man doesn't make you gay. There's a lot more to it. So you take all that really in-depth thought process and put that into a person. There's a huge struggle. So what stigma prevents is them from identifying and taking the necessary steps to protect themselves. It at times prevents people from going in to know their status because, hey, I'm negative until I'm told otherwise. And a test could tell me differently. They don't want to face that truth. They don't want to share their experiences with people. They find the courage to do that, then they at times and find out that they're positive. The stigma prevents them from going in to see their doctor or see others, especially in small communities where everybody knows everybody. And then if they do access services, sometimes they're very much scared to disclose it to others or to take their medicine because people will find it. And it's really important to minimize transmission is for a person who's living with the disease to reduce the amount of infection in their system so they become less infectious. Stigma, once we can overcome that, we can overcome a lot of current barriers.
I think that's an insight that only comes from being involved deeply. It makes a lot of sense to me. I want to ask Terry about her experience with the natives, but we're going to take a short break first. Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails about AIDS, HIV infections, particularly in Alaska. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Trevor Storrs. He's executive director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. And Terry Bramall is also with us. She's an HIV clinical specialist and physician assistant with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. We're talking about AIDS and HIV. We're going to talk a little bit about treatment. What we've just been talking about is how stigma, how cultural values may inhibit or are inhibiting people from seeking treatment, how some of our stigma even leads to laws and policies that distract or prevent some individuals from seeking the care they might need. And then if we don't know our status for this transmissible illness, then we are infected, we're going to increase the likelihood of others becoming infected. So the idea of stigma is something that Trevor Storrs has brought up, which I think is an important one. I said before the break I'd like to follow through from the Native standpoint. Would you, Terry, are stigma such as what you've just heard Trevor commenting on an issue within the Native population also, and is it true both in the in the natives in Anchorage or the big cities, as well as those who might live in some of the rural areas?
It's a huge issue. And actually, if you read about barriers around the world to testing and care, stigma always comes up at the top of the list for what we need to deal with. In the Native population, of course, a lot of them live in small rural communities, which just amplifies concerns about confidentiality, and it just tends to be more stigmatizing. People blame people for getting infected. People blame themselves for getting infected. There's still a lot of misunderstanding. It is about behaviors, but I read a really interesting study a couple years ago in a Journal of Public Health about the identical behaviors, depending on the sexual network you're in, are going to increase or decrease your risk substantially. So if you're in a network of people where you've got infection at higher numbers, you could do the exact same thing as someone else, but your risk is going to be much higher just because of the background prevalence.
There is a new national recommendation, if I'm not mistaken, to test everyone for HIV or AIDS. Is that true? And what's the maybe it's certain age groups. I don't want to say, maybe I should clarify that. And what's the rationale for that?
Well, the CDC has recommended that everybody knows their HIV status, and that, I guess, equates to test everyone, but it's not continually test and so forth. What's really important is looking at people's risk factors. So, for example, my mother, been married 40 years, no concerns that she and or her spouse, my father, have gone outside the relationship. There's been no signs and symptoms. They have been together way before HIV was at least first identified. The likelihood of her having it, is there a need for a test? Having the discussion, presenting it to her, she could probably decide, but I would probably recommend, I don't think you need a test. Mm-hmm. You're talking to a 20-year-old young man who has just come out in the past 2 years, identifies as gay, has had 10 sex partners over the past 2 years. Yes, you should know your status, and I encourage you to get tested on a regular basis and talking about that.
And I'll have to disagree just a little bit. In 2006...
Ooh, controversy. I love it.
CDC came out with the recommendations that all people accessing medical care between the ages of 13 and 64, which I think is an arbitrarily low cutoff, mm-hmm. should be offered the opportunity to know their HIV status. And part of that was to help destigmatize testing so that we weren't just focusing on risk because... I mean, certainly there are people at much higher risk who need to be tested, but we're still identifying people late in disease that didn't have any perceived risk, mm-hmm. Even when going back through their history. So trying to pick up that pool of people, because about 21% of people in the U.S. who have HIV don't know it, and they're responsible for almost half of new infections. Mm-hmm. So by identifying people... Mm-hmm. earlier in disease, we can do a lot more for prevention as well as individual health.
Yeah.
And it's coming from the concept, and I agree with you, Terry. It's not by having those discussions, it's basically doing an opt-out versus an opt-in program. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're encouraging. And that's kind of what I'm referring mm-hmm. to is it's not about the test. People can have their blood drawn and have a whole wealth of tests done. That does nothing for the individual. What the most important piece of it all through a testing process is what I was talking about, which is the conversation. Talking to them about their potential risk, what is going on. It builds awareness. It allows them to understand and do that self-assessment. If you just do a test, like with the cholesterol and all those other things, you're not even going to talk about HIV. They're never going to know their risk, and they're just going to continue going down the path. It's really, as they say, the pre- and post-test counseling that's really critical, and that's the discussion, and that's why the CDC came out with these recommendations. It gets physicians mm-hmm. who you think would be trained to talk about such human behaviors as sex, but they're not. They're really uncomfortable. They've never been trained, and it's an encouragement to start looking at this and having these important conversations.
I thought it had a lot to do with trying to get the number of new cases done also addressed. What we're seeing, again, as I understand it, is that the number of new cases in many parts of the world seems to be decreasing. That's probably a combination of treatment and how that treatment works, which we haven't talked about. But also we've got this problem with 1 in 5 people who are positive and particularly at risk of transmitting it to someone else, not aware of that. And if they were aware of it, then treatment could be offered, which may decrease the risk. They may be able to change some of their behaviors, which would decrease the risk. So I thought that was the primary reason, but I'm not a specialist. That made sense to me.
Well, and the second avenue to it is treatment is prevention. So as Terry pointed out, 1 in 5, and it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, it was 1 in 4. Mm-hmm. So we're making some headway, but 1 in 5 people who are positive don't even know their status. When somebody doesn't know their status, they're not in treatment, their disease is growing in them versus the amount of infection decreasing, as well as evidence has showed is when someone is identified as positive, they greatly, by 75 to 80%, decrease their behaviors that may put other people at risk. So they change their behaviors when identified, as well as by getting into treatment, and less infectious they are, so they can't transmit. That has a huge impact on potential new numbers of cases.
And we've known it in the field we've mm-hmm. suspected for years that if you get people's viral load, the amount of virus in their blood, mm-hmm. undetectable with meds, that they're going to be less infectious. And this summer, mm-hmm. I believe it was at the International Conference on AIDS, some conclusive studies came out from Africa and from other countries, including the U.S., that treatment truly is prevention, and that if you can have somebody on treatment and undetectable, their risk of transmitting the virus is very, very low.
Let me remind listeners again, if you've got questions or comments about HIV infections or AIDS, this is the time to give us a call. We'll be here for another 20 minutes or so. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Also, I'd remind anybody, if you wanted someone else to listen to this program or you wanted to listen again, you could go to line1@alaskapublic.org and look for Line 1, the program, and all of our programs are archived so that you could ask somebody to look at that or listen to it. And you can even go to iTunes and put down Line 1, and you can find a link to this particular podcast. Well, let's talk about treatment a little bit, Terry, that we have established in some of the comments we've made today that the treatment decreases the viral load, makes transmission less. We're seeing fewer new cases. People are living longer. Trevor, you've mentioned it. It's a chronic, more like a chronic disease now. And I guess there's no greater evidence of that than we think about someone like Magic Johnson, who was diagnosed years ago now and seems to still be living a pretty healthy life. I don't know for sure, but it's pretty clear that he admitted that he had an AIDS infection. So it's a different disease than it was in the early 80s when we first recognized it because of treatment.
We've made great strides in medical treatment and continue to make strides. Even in the last, I'd say, 5 years, We've come up with simpler regimens with fewer side effects that have made a big difference. You know, if somebody can take, back in the mid-90s when we first came up with highly active antiretroviral therapy, we had people taking meds sometimes seven times a day, sometimes with food, sometimes without food, or with fat or not fat. And it was very difficult for anybody to be successful with that. Now it could be as simple as one pill once a day. We have two different regimens that are one pill once a day or three pills once a day that really simplify it, make people much more successful in not missing their meds and thus run the risk of resistance. And the long-term side effects, well, we don't know the really long-term side effects because the meds haven't been around long enough, but they seem to be greatly decreased. A lot of people take their meds and they never really feel any different.
And I guess it's important to say this is not a curable problem like a strep throat. You take some penicillin for 10 days and you're done and that's it. You might get reinfected. This is a problem that a real cure is still eluding us to some degree. Actually, it's eluding us
to a great degree.
To a finite degree. So it does require lifelong treatment, it appears, for most people at this point.
Yes, and also to mention that we always have people on at least three different drugs, often four and sometimes more, to have a potent regimen where the virus is suppressed and doesn't. When it's not suppressed, it can develop resistance easily. It's a very sloppy virus. It makes billions of copies a day and makes a lot of mistakes, and those mistakes lead to, there are mutations that lead to drug resistance.
Yeah, so if one of those mistakes turns out to be beneficial to the virus and makes it resistant to the treatment, then it's got a field day going on. So.
And one other thing, a new way that we're looking at HIV infection over the last 3 years or so, now that we've got such good treatment to preserve the immune system and people are living a long time, we're realizing that there's a huge component of inflammation that leads to the long-term negative effects of the disease. And so we've become more aggressive about treating, not just treating the virus, which causes inflammation, but treating, you know, cholesterol and looking at bone loss and all the other diseases of aging that seem to be somewhat accelerated and occurring at earlier ages in HIV-infected people.
I hadn't heard about that aspect, but basically what you're saying is anybody who has a chronic disease also has increased metabolic needs, and this inflammation is taking up more and more energy so that the consequences of aging may be accelerated, if I can say it that simply,
yes,
to help people understand.
And I think they're finding that with a number of infectious diseases like hepatitis as well.
Yeah, and chronic disease in general, you could say this. I'm not an expert, but I would think that would make sense. I have an email. It says, and this relates to funding and cost, which you can't live in America and not know that there's some issues related to cost to treatment in this country. How secure is federal funding that provides for care, treatment, and drugs for people living with HIV in Alaska? So who's paying for most of the care for people with HIV infections and AIDS is the first question. And then if what percentage is the government, and then how secure is that funding is the question.
Well, here in Alaska, your primary funder is the federal government, and that's pretty well national, whether it be through grants like the Ryan White or HOPWA, anything of that nature, and or Medicaid, Medicare, so forth. And then you have private insurance if people do have that. How secure is federal funding? Well, we are living in 2011, we're coming on to 2012, and we're in no better place than we were. There's a lot of issues around debt and so forth, and where to cut money and so forth. So how secure is it? Well, everything we've been told at this point, that the funding for Ryan White, which is a primary funder that covers medication for those who don't have insurance, it's called ADAP, AIDS Drug Assistance Program, as well as the pieces that pay for medical treatment, like where Terry is and so forth. And we also have funding at Neighborhood Health Center, Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. They do similar work to what Terry does for the non-natives here in Anchorage. It's my understanding we're going to see flat, but if the CDC, or I should say HRSA, that's where those dollars come from, experience a major cut, we could experience a cut. So it's really up in the air. The big question always is around ADAP, that AIDS Drug Assistance Program. As Terry spoke, medications is really important. All the other things won't be worth anything without those drugs. It's been very, very important in treatment of individuals. And those three drugs can equal somebody on average around $1,500 a month without insurance. They do have insurance. They could even still have a copay of $400 to $600. So without this kind of program available to them, there'd be a lot of people that would have no medication. And then the security of that program, even if it stays flat funded, we're expecting to surpass our funding within a couple years. It potentially could be sooner if there's still a greater need. So it's really up in the air. So it's not all that safe. And then on the prevention side, the CDC has done a reallocation of the dollars that they do have. They are focusing on the harder hit communities. So we're talking large communities like New York, California, San Francisco, LA, things of that nature. And smaller incident states like ourselves are seeing less dollars. By within 4 years, we will potentially have 50% or less than what we currently have. So we're dropping under $1 million towards prevention. And as we talked about, that's what helps pay for HIV testing and the other interventions that we do to develop that awareness, to encourage people to know their status, and also to take the necessary precautions to minimize their risk. So there's a lot of things that we're going to see change here in our community that we, as an organization, are going to have to be very savvy in figuring out how we're going to continue to do the strong work that we do to have that impact, to keep our numbers low. Currently, we're on average between 30 and 40 new cases a year here in Alaska, and that's been plateaued for over a decade. Our concern is as we see less funding, we may see that number increase. But again, only time will tell.
We've also seen the death rate drop significantly, which means our pool of people living with HIV continues to grow. And the guidelines for starting medications have been expanding to where we're probably moving towards recommending medications for almost everybody with HIV rather than waiting for their immune system to decline to a certain extent. So flat funding basically means cuts.
Mm-hmm. Hard decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is these are hard decisions that are played out day in and day out throughout this country as our economies are going down. And if we, you know, the costs of not treating AIDS, as you've implied already, is going to be much more expensive, but there may be
it's
tough
deferred
choices. Yeah,
right.
It's deferred and you, Terry, you made a comment that I had also read recently, which is I think interesting. Is so the past paradigm for treatment of HIV infections is to await until there is AIDS for treatment. If now you correct me if I'm wrong, but now more and more the idea is to because of evidence, to go back and treat immediately, very quickly, to decrease the likelihood of transmission, I guess, once, maybe to increase outcomes. Is that the reason?
Yeah, I've been doing this for about 10 years. And when we started, the recommendations were to start medications when the CD4 count, which is the immune system marker that we use, is somewhere between 200 and 350.
Losing the battle.
And then, right, exactly. That was fairly far along in the infection. And then, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it went up to below 350, definitely treat. The last couple of years, it's become quite clear that below 500, definitely treat. And above 500, the experts are about 50-50 split on whether to treat or not. But as more and more evidence comes in about inflammation and the long-term effects of that, as well as the treatment as prevention, we're really expanding, in this country anyway, who we believe should be on therapy.
Trevor, I said I'd give you a chance to talk about, or I ask you if you would like a chance, I'd like you to talk about the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. You've commented at some of the efforts that you're making. Could you tell us a little bit about the association and your purpose and different programs you might be initiating?
Absolutely. The 4A's has been around for just over 25 years. We just celebrated that 25th anniversary last year. And we, or our mission is to be a key collaborator in two core areas. One of them is services to those living with the disease and their families, and then also on the HIV prevention side, which includes eliminating new transmission and also addressing stigma. On the side of services, our primary service that we provide is case management. People come to us to understand the systems out there and the variety of services. So basically what we do with folks is we look at what are their resources, what are their needs, how do they come together, how can they better fit together, and then we start filling in the gaps. So many people will not have a primary care provider or a medical home, so we make sure they get linked up to that. We look at the medication side. We look at housing, nutrition. We have AIDS housing that we provide. We have a food bank. We do delivery of meals, things of that nature. We link people up to other services if they need mental health, substance abuse, whatever it could be, to make sure that their needs are met. And the purpose of that is HIV at times is much lower. You know, for a lot of people, if I don't have a place to live, they can't do their medications. They can't keep them refrigerated. They can't keep them secure, whatever it may be. And more importantly, I don't care about taking a pill. I just need to figure out where I'm going to stay warm tonight. If we can take those more important things off their list that HIV moves up, they then can take an active participation in their treatment, suppress the virus, and also ensure that they don't take any risk that could put other people at risk of transmitting. On the prevention side, we do free HIV testing. People can come into our agency between 9 and 4:30 Monday to Friday, walk-ins or call for an appointment and get a free HIV test. We have the syringe exchange program. We distribute condoms throughout the state. We do direct outreach. We go to high designated locations within the community to target high-risk groups based off our Alaska statistics. We do outreach through the internet. We do like World AIDS Day, big awareness campaign. We've did a big social marketing campaign, which was Get It On, things of that nature, anything to bring awareness to the community. We're small in size. We're about 17 folks, but we're responsible for 91% of the state. There's a small organization similar to us, but much, much smaller up in Fairbanks, Interior AIDS, wonderful organization. They serve roughly 30 to 35 folks, where we serve between 250 and 300. We have a satellite office in Juneau to make sure Southeast is covered. And then prevention works primarily in the urban settings because it's so hard to get out to the rural areas.
Terry, you mentioned before the program that not only are you involved in care at the Alaska Native Health Consortium, you're also provide some information for people. Could you maybe talk about how people can get information about HIV and AIDS?
Yes, we're a local performance site for the Northwest AIDS Education and Training Center out of the University of Washington. So we provide provider education around the state to doctors, nurses, pharmacists, dentists, social workers, etc. And we're also available for consultation for any patient, regardless of whether they're Native or not, to help primary care providers co-manage the patients and make sure they're getting the best care.
Let me remind listeners also, if you go to the web address, line1@alaskapublic.org, today's program have links to the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, World AIDS Day, and the CDC website on HIV and AIDS as well. How accurate is the testing? What are the provisos about testing that people need to understand?
Probably the most important thing is we get a lot of people who walk through the door and go, I did something I shouldn't have last night. I want to get tested. Mm-hmm. Well, with all the tests, there is basically a three-month window period. What the test tests for is the antibodies and not the disease itself. So it can take up to 3 months for those antibodies to form. So there's a three-month window period. So today is the 28th of November or 27th, something like that. So 3 months out. So we're talking the test, if we did it today, would only test up to August. The rapid test, if it comes back negative, it's negative. So on the 28th of August, it would mean, or today, it would mean by August 28th, you have not contracted it. In the past 3 months, it does not address any risky behaviors. If it comes back positive, it's 99.6% accurate. So what we do is we do a second test similar to the first. Some people do a blood draw. We do a swab, and we send it off, and they do what's called the Western blot, which is a more sensitive test, and they determine if that test was accurate or not.
There is some new technology coming online and testing where they're actually going to be able to pick up it's antigen testing, so they'll actually be able to pick up
evidence of the virus.
And it may be as early as 2 weeks after infection.
Wow.
So there's a number of tests being rolled out. They're getting more and more sensitive. And we were just at Infectious Disease Society of America conference in Boston, and one of the docs there said, we're just going to have to get over the Western blot, which has been our confirmatory test ever since we've known about HIV, that, you know, with all the new technology, it's going to be easier to diagnose and more accurate and earlier.
We've got about 2 minutes left. I've got a couple of questions. One of them is, I guess I'll go ahead and ask, I'm trying to think what's the most efficient use of my time, but what about the effectiveness of condoms in preventing the spread of HIV during sex?
Very, very important, and they're very effective. Condoms are tested. I've heard people, oh, condoms are constantly breaking on me and so forth. They go through rigorous testing. I encourage people to look it up on YouTube. You'd be amazed what they go through. They are a great way of reducing your risk of not just HIV, but STDs. It can decrease 10,000-fold is the stat that is out there. So highly encourage people, use the condoms. Find condoms that work for you. There's different types, different sizes, so forth. Work beyond the barrier, whether it be how it feels, how the stimulation works, things of that nature. Work through that, find the condom that works for you, and have some fun.
And we do recommend that you avoid the use of condoms with non-oxynol 9, which is a spermicide, for the intention of preventing STDs or HIV, as there have been some studies showing that irritation from that could actually promote spreading of infection. So they're okay for preventing pregnancy, but it's just not recommended that we use them. And there's still a lot of them out there.
About 30 seconds. Any final comments? What do we want people to hear and remember the most out of today?
Talk. Have conversations. You know what your risk behaviors are. And more importantly, you know the people around you, what risk levels they have. Talk about the disease and help us spread the word, not just today, not just on World AIDS Day, but for 365 days a year.
Get tested.
Get tested. Talk about testing. Educate.
All right. Thanks very much to Trevor and Terry for being with us today. Very much appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to continue today's conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find links at the new website, alaskapublic.org. Why don't you join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1 as well. At that time, we're going to be talking about some early experiments with blood transfusions in the 17th century Europe and see what this might tell us a little bit about 20th century medicine. Our guest will be Holly Tucker. She's the author of Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor. Dave Waldron helped me today with the engineering. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.